Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Listeners to this program and listeners to my other show on the station, my old music show called Filler Up, that airs Thursday nights at 9, will know, as they've known from the very beginning when I started doing Dave's Gone By, that I'm a huge Bob Dylan fan. He was a tremendous influence on my thinking processes, my musical life, my musical tastes, and that has not changed. I mean, he's the one I turn to most often from all different aspects of his career when I need a musical jolt, or when I need to go sort of back in time to a place where I was a few years ago, or just to be wowed again by his lyrics or the sound of his music or the sound of the band behind him. There's nobody quite like Bob Dylan, and you can approach his music from all different angles. And an author named Christopher Ricks, an academic author, as a matter of fact, has gone through a bunch of his songs, a bunch of his albums, and synthesized a kind of concept involving what Dylan is doing insofar as sin and redemption and salvation. How many songs go into those directions and talk about that, either very explicitly or sometimes more subtly, of these issues that Dylan is grappling with. And Christopher Ricks' book is called Dylan's Visions of Sin. It's published by HarperCollins. It's over 500 pages long, so I'm sure he gets into a bunch of songs very specifically. And we'll get into a few here on the show, as we have Christopher Ricks on the phone with us in the neighborhood. Hi, Christopher.
Good afternoon.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. I can't say hi. I'm English, but do go on.
Where are you from in England? From London or from...
Born just outside London. Have lived in this country now for 20 years because I'm married to an American.
Oh, you have my condolences. But how did you... When did the Dylan thing happen for you? When did it click in your head that there's nobody like Dylan?
It wasn't as early as it should be. That is, the late 60s, not the early 60s. When I was, I'd been teaching in Berkeley in 1965, and I was a bit haughty and snooty, and I didn't listen to Dylan. That is, I only heard him. I think you've got to listen to him. By the time I was back at Smith College in 1968, I was listening all right, and I think that he's a genius, as you do.
Right. And what got you first? Was it the music? The lyrics or the sound of it, or the
I think it is the combination, all right. I mean, you know, the art of song is a triple art, isn't it? The art of the poem could be the art of words only on a page. That mm-hmm. doesn't have to be. There's his voice or voices. There's what the music can do, and there's the words, and each is equally important. And it's imperative not to forget the existence of the others. But just as you're allowed to quote some Shakespeare and talk about how magnificently the words create something for you, so I think you can talk about the words of Dylan without demeaning the art of song.
And would you say, I mean, it's never fair to do real comparisons, but I think it can be said that there's something about Dylan that goes over pretty much everyone else. I mean, even the Beatles, even brilliant lyricists like Ira Gershwin and Sondheim and Tom Waits. What is it about Bob?
Well, I think it's a great many things. I mean, that is, he is wonderfully prolific or fertile. You just think of the sheer number of songs, and then you think of the extraordinary variety of kinds of song. I mean, there are songs of religious awe, there are songs of political anger, there are songs of deep personal love, there are narratives and ballads. It's the immense range of things that he's done so widely and so deeply.
Well put. Very well put.
Thank you. That's how I earn my living. I'll try to.
Modesty becomes it. So you decided for this book to take a very particular approach to, because as I said, you can take a number of them, but yours really has to do with seven deadly sins, the four cardinal virtues, and three heavenly graces. Please don't ask me to name them, because I can't.
You've forgotten.
I've never had any virtues, so it's all sinning for me. But why that?
Well, it was partly my being struck by how often the word sin, the very word sin, turns up in songs throughout his lifetime. Then it turns up in very, very different kinds of song. It's in personal songs and love songs. It's in religious songs. It's in the political songs, what he calls the politics of sin. I think he's always been a religious artist. One of the reasons I honor him is that I'm not myself religious at all, and I find in his art a respect. I find that I'm able to respect and understand systems of belief that I don't myself hold. Now, I think that's one of the great things that we get from art, is sympathetic access to systems of belief that we don't hold. We're not very good at being sympathetic and respectful.
No.
Sometimes there are people that we love who very unexpectedly, as it were, vote Republican or are Christians or whatever it might be, whatever kind of doesn't ordinarily fit us. It's a great gift in art to be able to do this, and I think Dylan is a great religious artist, and those of us who are not religious stand to gain from understanding that.
Well, what are the underpinnings of Dylan's religion musically? I mean, obviously born Jewish, born again for a while, then God knows where he's at personally right now. But in terms of his lyrics and his output, what is his religious faith and feelings about sin and salvation?
Well, I think one of the things that he most importantly understands about sin and salvation, you seem very reluctant to mention damnation. I noticed when you introduced this that you talked about redemption and salvation. There's this other thing, you know, that you and I may be heading for. But one of the things that he understands is that it is terrifically easy to fall into sins at the very moment that you condemn them. It's terrifically easy to give way to blind anger in a song that is an attack on people being so angry. It's very easy to attack lust and to really rather enjoy imagining lust in a way in which these films that are against the pornographic industry, films like Boogie Nights, actually go along with the sins that they pretend to be terrifically against. You know how often the newspapers will deplore the morbid interest in people's private lives, see page 7 for photographs of them taken by paparazzi.
There you go.
So the songs, I think the concept of sin gives Dylan a perpetual reminder as an artist of what he is up against. That is, let's have a song about pride, like a Rolling Stone, which doesn't give way to pride. It is a song about pride. It knows that pride is very strange of the seven deadly sins, because it's the only one that actually is also a virtue.
Hmm.
I mean, that is pride. You know, I'm proud of my work. I'm proud of that.
Yeah.
There isn't an envy form of that, or a lust form of that, or a sloth form of that. So pride, I think, one of the reasons why it's one of his very greatest songs, I think, is that pride is a really strange and contrarious thing. And he captures that in this song, which is not gloating and not exaltation, but is a kind of thrilled horror at what's happening to somebody and what could happen to any of us.
Well, now you don't act so proud.
You don't talk so loud.
I think it's also more of a vanity kind of pride that he's going after there. So,
well,
not necessarily the good kind of pride, like, oh, you know, I'm speaking of a lust pride, like I'm a 15-incher sort of thing. Which I wish, but, you know.
Well, I know what you mean, but I think that he knows the difference between vanity and pride, too. If he'd wanted a different word, you remember Disease of Conceit, which is a very, very good song, and it's important. It's about the particular form of pride, which is conceit, which he knows is smaller and in some ways more dangerous, because more daily than the sort of great pride that the general might have. You know, we're all in danger of being conceited all the time.
So at what point did you really go through enough of his material to realize, okay, it isn't just more than a random thing. This is something worth creating a big academic book about.
Well, you keep saying academic. It's the only reason I dislike you as yet. I mean,
give it time, sir.
You're quite right that I'm bald, and you're quite right that I'm in my 70s, and that I learned my living as a professor. But I do think the book's, I mean, it's an academic book, but it quotes The Onion, you know. It's got some very good things from The Onion in it.
Well, first of all, academic is not my word. I mean, I'm sitting attached to you and to the book when I was doing the research on it. And second of all, speaking of criticism, the one major criticism I've seen leveled at your book, because nobody has any, that I've seen any problems with your essential thesis or the things that you're saying necessarily about the songs themselves, but that you have a bit of pride in your word-isms, in your punnery, in the way that you're phrasing things. That you
I
might
do.
Go
I
over
quite often overwrite. I mean, I do quite often overwrite. I need discipline. Quite a lot of people who underwrite or can't write at all, so I'm not actually going to be abject about it, but it is true, on reflection, I shouldn't have made that pun. There are some quite good puns in there, I can tell you. I'm quite pleased of the thought that if you were a grudge, wouldn't you like to be held? And that's very relevant to, you know, only a pawn, even the pawns must hold a grudge and so on. Anyway, I mean, yeah, I overwrite. Thank you.
But tell me more. Give me some more examples of Dylan's work. Hopefully some of more of the recognizable songs. I mean, I know Disease of Conceit. I think it's on the same album with I and I. Is it?
It's back on Oh Mercy.
Yeah. Oh, it's on Oh Mercy. Sorry.
Well, I believe so. It's true. I can't always do that. I can't always conjure any longer exactly which album I'm
sure.
on.
But a song or two that we'd be fairly familiar with, where Dylan really grapples with issues of, you know, beyond our spiritual, or into our spiritual nature, beyond our corporal nature.
Well, I think one of his greatest songs is The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll. It's a song which is tempted all the way through to give way to the anger which William Zanzinger gave way to when he killed this woman quite needlessly at a Baltimore Hotel Society gathering. He wasn't found guilty of murder. The song doesn't think he should have, doesn't say he should have been found guilty of murder, but he was guilty of murderousness. And, you know, the judge stared at the person who killed for no reason.
So he is guilty of murder. Yeah, okay. Continue.
What do you mean?
Sorry.
You mean the verdict?
Yeah.
No, the verdict. He wasn't found guilty of murder. And nor should he have been.
What?
What do you mean, what?
Okay, William Zanzinger.
He's not found guilty of murder. The cops kind of wrote him in custody down to the station and booked William Zanzinger for first-degree murder.
Mm-hmm.
He's not found guilty of first-degree murder, and that's one of the reasons why he gets only a six-month sentence. You're listening to WGBB. This is Christopher Ricks, who's recently published a book called Dylan's Visions of Sin.
Let's roll back into talking about Hattie Carroll, okay? Yes, the song says that, I assume that the song says he's convicted of murder, but he gets a very, very light sentence because murdering a black person is no big deal. That's what the song always said to me. You're saying that he was not convicted of murder, and that's why he got a short...
murder, and the song doesn't say that he was. The leniency of the sentence is a shock, and Dylan conveys that brilliantly with that tiny pause between A and 6 months. Judge handed out strongly for penalty and repentance, William Zanzinger with a 6 month sentence. And it's marvelous that he doesn't give vent to, he doesn't do what I would have been tempted to do in my easy indignation with a, Jesus Christ, can you believe it, 6 month sentence? Dylan doesn't do that. There's an equanimity and a plainness in the song which is contrasted with the violence of somebody who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning.
Right.
Now, that's a description of murderousness, which is everywhere in English and American life, and is not quite the same as murder. Do you see what I mean?
Well, it wouldn't be quite the same as murder if she'd only been conked on the head and, you know, had needed a few stitches. It's the same as murder when she dies. And he threw a cane at her.
No, because the medical story is not... I mean, if you're really going into the ins and outs of the legal story, the among the things that brought the sentence down was the condition of her physical health at the time when she struck on the head. And it's important to remember that he hits her. It's not all right that he hits her, but she got killed by a blow, lay slain by a cane. And that word cane is at once lighter and heavier than you might expect. It's heavier because of C-A-I-N.
Right.
All these murders go back to an original murder, and Dylan repeatedly turns back to Cain and Abel in his songs. But there's also a lightness in the word cane that brings it clear that it's not De Niro with a baseball bat at the beginning of some mafia film. She got killed by a blow, lay slain by Cain. Now, he shouldn't, you know, I mean, I'm not defending Zanzinger. I mean, he sounds as if he's still a thoroughly nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
That. But it's not a song that says somebody was found guilty of murder, but nevertheless got a six-month sentence. It really doesn't say that.
From the song itself, I think we're led to believe that it was a guilty sentence, and the judge said, it's kind of like To Kill a Mockingbird. where the guy is obviously innocent, but they convict him anyway because he's black. Here's someone who's well-connected, who's well-liked and white, and got a little mad and killed a black person, and they can't let him go because, you know, he did do this. So they give him a little six-month sentence. And also, I think it's a little different in the sense that when he says, it's not that now is the time for you to be enraged, now is the time for you to go jump and be angry. Now is the time for your tears. Now is the time for you to really weep and be upset.
Well, we agree that the last verse of the song is about a terrible failure to take with sufficient seriousness what comes before the courts. The last verse of the song does not use the word murder, nor should it. I mean, you know, that is the
second degree murder, or what is it, manslaughter then? I mean, I guess this is semantics. Okay, manslaughter.
But it's not just semantics. If you were on trial, you're not going to say it's just a matter of semantics whether they're getting you for manslaughter or for murder. I mean, you're right. I mean, come on. I mean, it's a song about a terrible injustice that is done both by Zanzinger and by the system which treats him with terrible leniency.
Good. Okay, yes.
But we agree about that. It's just that you think that the last verse says he's found guilty of murder, but he's given a six-month sentence.
Okay.
It doesn't say that, and he wasn't.
Okay, fair enough. True. So, but it's also the fact that I guess it's kind of interesting that you mention the way he did not hold back. Dylan keeps asking us to hold back from our rage and our venting.
Yeah.
But again, when he says tears, he's saying he's hold back, like, don't weep because the story's not over yet.
Yes,
it gets
agree,
worse.
Yes.
That's where I'm going.
I think you put that very well, but what I'm wanting to get at is the way in which one of the really powerful things when people go out after sins is that they not give in to them. It's so easy to be terrifically proud when you attack pride, to be terrifically envious when you attack envy. I mean, it's very, very easy to do that. Positively Fourth Street is a song that deeply dislikes the pretend friendship of somebody who really envies you.
Mm.
You got a lot of nerve to say you were my friend. When I was down, you just stood there grinning. So it is a song about gloating and envy and ingratitude. You know, you say good luck, but you don't mean it.
Right.
Why don't you just come out once and scream it? Let's get your feelings out. Now, for me, that's to be contrasted with Song for Woody, which is the expression of an extremely beautiful, lucid, simple generosity and gratitude. He's really grateful to Woody Guthrie. The program is Dave's Gone By. The station is WGBB. This is Christopher Ricks, who has recently published a book on Bob Dylan called Dylan's Visions of Sin. Dylan has a genius for gratitude. It comes out in the Scorsese film. He's wonderfully grateful to an immense number of people. And that's a kind of genius. Most of us are not good at being grateful or receiving expressions of gratitude, even.
Well, and it's also that comes with age. I mean, at the time, in the 60s and 70s, obviously, as you see in the film, he's just besieged and beleaguered by everybody.
Yeah.
Back then, I mean, he was picking up and dropping people like this, whether they deserved to be or not, and he would steal melodies, because he was like the sponge, the sieve. I think in later years now, he can look back and be a bit more generous.
But Song for Woody is one of his only two songs of his own on his first album. I mean, that's on his very first album. Now, I don't know how you can say that Song for Woody represents his having got on in years and having told, you know, he can now afford to this and that. It's on his first album.
Okay. No, that's fine. That's on, but again, he recorded the first album before he was a star. He felt very lucky that John Hammond plucked him out and said, okay, let's record you because you got a good review in the New York Times.
Yeah, well, there always is luck, though I think that there's... it's not just a matter of Dylan having been lucky, is it? I mean, you know, he has things going for him that go a bit beyond luck.
Oh, well, yes, of course. Let's get to...
You seem to dislike him as a person. You seem to admire his art and dislike him as a person.
Well, I've never met the man.
No, but you convey this thing, you know, you drop people whether they should have been dropped or not. You mean you think Joan Baez is completely in the right and Dylan is in the wrong? Or what?
Well, aside from Joan Baez, and that's a good person to bring up, but in the biographies I've read of him, and I've read a few over the years, and in the a couple of people that I've spoken to who were friends for a while, and then, you know, when he moved on, they were kind of like to the background, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess we all do that to some extent. I mean, again, if I start pointing at his sins, you know, I have to go look at my own and say, well, what friends don't I talk to from 5 years ago from school?
That's a fair point.
Yeah.
Do you think Suze Rotolo was very good in the film, though, in her the simple preservation of her great respect and affection for him?
Yeah.
I thought she was really good.
But they also didn't talk to the wife or mention the wife that he beat.
Did he beat her?
Apparently he hit her, yes. That was, or maybe they just said that in the court proceedings in order to get a divorce. We are talking to Christopher Ricks, author of the book Dylan's Visions of Sin, published by HarperCollins, and we're talking about all these aspects of Dylan's songs that have to do with the way that people sin, or his personages sin in the songs, and that we can't really step far away from them because we see what we do in relation to what those characters do, and we can't just point a finger and say, oh, he's evil, oh, that was bad. Although he does do that in Masters of War. I mean, that's kind of an exception that proves the rule. That one where it's just pure finger point and then, like, you know, I'm gonna make sure you're dead. Let's pick another song. Let's think of another song that illustrates some of the things that you're talking about in the book, Dylan's Visions of Sin.
Well, I think a Handy Dandy, I don't know whether you know Handy Dandy, and that's a song about celebrity. You know, controversy surrounds him. He's been around the world and back again. Something in the moonlight still hounds him. So it's about what it would like to be in People or National Enquirer,
mm-hmm.
and it's about the horrible ways in which we actually envy these people, but look forward to their getting their comeuppance. You know how those celebrity magazines are about. These people are very rich, and they're more beautiful than us, and they have this wonderful lifestyle, and they're doomed. Their marriage is hopeless, and so on. Well, I think it's an indictment of a celebrity culture, what it is like to be made into some sort of celebrity or image or icon, and so on. Those figures often get into his songs, people of that kind, and he's at once fascinated by it and rightly in awe of it. It's dangerous, it's sort of poisonous, and that's why he treats the media people as he does in the great Scorsese film. They ask these insolently stupid questions. I mean, the man who says, I've never heard you sing, and who says, so I'm doing my job. Excuse me, if you're interviewing, I mean, Dylan doesn't say, if you're interviewing me, you are not doing my job if you have never been bothered to listen to anything that I sing. Do you remember the interviewer says to him, do you care what you sing? And Dylan says, do you ask the Beatles that? The person who asks him, how many protest singers are there now who such and such? And Dylan says, 136.
And that's a great line.
And the man says, exactly one. And he said, well, somewhere between 136 and 142. These people, it's a world that at once celebrates a celebrity and tries to drag him down into squalor and exposure. They're always trying to expose him.
Well, actually, you mentioned before why I seem to have a negative view of him as a person, a person that I've never met, just from reading about him and seeing him in Don't Look Back. And that is part of it, because as a journalist myself, I can empathize with those people asking him the questions, and as someone who's sometimes had to interview four or five people in the course of a day, not being able to read their books, not being or to do more than skim a tear shaver or a chapter, you're up there trying to do your best and asking, and it's not your fault that this man's in a bad place and has been asked the same question 30 times.
Not be. I mean, I think as a journalist, you should sympathize with good journalists, and you should not sympathize at all with bad journalists, because bad journalists drag down the profession to which you honorably belong. I mean, I don't understand why you would sympathize with somebody who chooses to go and interview Dylan but can't be bothered to listen to one song that the man has ever sung. Why do you sympathize with that person?
Well, because that's what they were told to do. I mean,
a lot of people have been told to do things that they really shouldn't do over the centuries. You mean he's just doing his job, like a torturer or something? I don't know. People shouldn't.
You can't make that direct comparison.
Well, he's not doing his job. He's failing to do his job. And I think if you care about the line of work, I mean, I don't sympathize with teachers who don't give, university professors who don't get round to marking the students' papers because they're very busy. I don't sympathize with them. I think they shouldn't be sympathized with. And I think it's odd to take the line that you sympathize with the journalist just because you're a journalist.
Well, but as long as if the journalists are asking specifically nasty
questions. Do you care what you're saying is an insolent question.
Okay.
And if you phoned me up and said, do I care about this 500-page academic book, I would think, well, screw you, I could stop talking to you. I mean, why should I for no reason at all talk to a total stranger who asked me an insolently aggressive question, which you haven't yet done.
Okay. I'm getting ready. No, I'm kidding.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
All right.
Insolence and aggression. Let's see. Seeing Salvation. What is your overall thought about that era when he converted and when he was doing the Christian music for about three albums?
Mm-hmm. Well, I value those albums very, very highly, partly, as I said to you at the very beginning, because I'm not a Christian. Some people value them because they are Christians. Others value them if they hold my beliefs, because they think that entertaining seriously some beliefs you don't hold is a really important thing for human beings to be able to do. And we're not good at doing it. And we only ever do it with the help of people whom we love who disagree with us, or with the help of works of art that we love that we disagree with. So that I think he was always religious, and of course there were Christian songs long before the Christian, the phase of those three albums.
Mm-hmm.
Sign on the Cross is perhaps his greatest Christian song in some respects. He's never released it, but it's there in the Book of Words, and you can get a bootleg tape of it, and it's a smash of a song. And I think from the beginning he's been fascinating. He's always been a religious artist. I think those albums are very good, and they mostly got a bad press. There was some surreptitious anti-Semitism bent on them. The Berkeley Barb managed to say, something is happening and you don't know what it is, do you, Mr. Jew?
Wow.
Pretending that it was an anti-Christian remark, while, of course, also being an anti-Semitic remark. So I'm very glad now that he still sings those songs in concert. I mean, most concerts now have one of the Christian songs, at least, in there. And they're very, very fine songs. For me, they rank with George Herbert's poems.
May I ask what you were raised as? I mean, you say that you don't have a... I'm sorry?
Oh, raised... Oh, yeah, no, I was Church of England.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't believe that... I don't believe that God exists.
Oh, okay. Must have been kind of interesting taking this topic then. Do you believe that sin and salvation exist?
Oh, yes. I don't think religion, and certainly not Christianity, has a monopoly of concern with sin and salvation and damnation. Really don't. I think people do damn themselves here and now on this planet, irrespective of immortal life.
Oh, okay.
And I think people save themselves with wonderful redemptive glory. I mean, I've been told that the book is really kind of heavily Christian and so on, and that I'm just kidding myself that I'm Christian, really. No, I'm not. My oldest child is a Christian, but I'm not a Christian.
Hmm. What
is your faith? Let me turn it back.
Take a wild guess.
I have no idea. You're a kind of rationalist.
Thank you very much. And also, my last name is Lefkowitz.
Okay.
I mean, I think you can, come on, you can give it a shot. Give it a whirl.
Well, I know that there's a difference between Jewishness and Judaism, and I know it from kind of personal experience and so on. So I don't know anything about somebody's religion from the fact that they are or aren't Jewish, because many of the Jews that I know have no religious faith at all.
Interesting. Now that is a great answer. That's really, and it's very true. But I have a smidgen of actual faith and a bucket load of culture.
Okay. Very good. Well, don't lose touch with either of them. We better draw this to a close, just because life must go on, as the Beatles say, how the life goes on. Got anything else to ask me?
Okay, yeah, let's make this the last question. What would you most like readers to draw from, both your book and then from your book about Dylan and Dylan's own work?
Well, I'd like to think in terms of the book that people might grant that I had noticed some things about how these songs work so well that they hadn't noticed. I mean, literary critics are just in the business of noticing some things on behalf of other people, and sometimes that's presumptuous and condescending of them, but I've read a lot of literary criticism where I feel really grateful. There was a really wonderful, wise, funny pun there, and I'd never noticed it, and thanks for drawing my attention to it. Had I been sufficiently vigilant and imaginative, maybe I would have noticed it before I died, but meanwhile, thanks a lot. I mean, artists are people who notice relations between the things that they notice, And critics are people who come along and help us do some noticing about that fact. So that would please me. But I think gratitude to Dylan really is more important to me than gratitude to me. I mean, fortunately, I don't live on the royalties of a book. I mean, I live as a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So that there's a sense in which, though, it would please me if people felt that the book had been worth writing on and worth reading. What matters is the extraordinary good fortune of living at the same time as Dylan.
Let me ask you, I do have to ask one more kind of closer question. I do.
Okay.
What's your Desert Island Dylan disc?
Well, I think Blonde on Blonde is the greatest single album, but I would be tempted to take, if I'm allowed, the two discs that sort of sometimes is and sometimes isn't. I'd take the English issue of the Essential Bob Dylan, which has 6 more tracks than the American issue for some reason. So you've got 36 tracks. And it is terrifically well chosen, and it's remastered, and I think it's the best anthology of Dylan put out by his people, the British or English Essential Bob Dylan. I think it's better than any of the greatest hits albums. But Blonde on Blonde, for the English, his art of love is even more moving and deep than the very fine things that he's written out of social conscience, social consciousness, or out of religious awe.
Well, that sounds like a next book right there, Dylan and Love. I mean,
I'm going to rest on my laurels, well, just as they are.
Well,
thanks for your company.
Welcome back to Dave's Gone By. Gosh, I could do this kind of show every week, playing Bob Dylan songs and then listening to a brilliant, truly brilliant person discussing and analyzing this music that we love.